Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
On November 25th, in the year 1095, Pope Urban II, from a raised platform outside the town of Clermont, France, issued a public call to Christians to help defend the Holy Lands in Byzantium, the Eastern Christian Empire, from an onslaught of Seljuk Turks, a rising empire in the Middle East. Just less than a year later, several waves of Christians began a journey that would put them into violent conflict with Muslim civilization. By 1099, with roughly 80 to 90% of their forces killed or having deserted the mission, Christian soldiers liberated Jerusalem. And so went the First Crusade. Over the course of the next two centuries, an additional seven or eight campaigns, varying in scope and size, kept Western and Muslim civilizations in a state of conflict. The two centuries between 1095 and 1291 became known collectively as the era of the Crusades. Today, the period of the Crusades looms large in popular mythology, with tales of looting and plundering, and is seen by many scholars as a dark blight on the history of Europe. Indeed, historical memories of the Crusades have been cited as a possible justification for Islamic hostility and terrorism towards the West in contemporary times. What really provoked the Crusades? Who participated in them, and why? How did a relatively small band of European crusaders defeat Muslim armies that had a significant advantage in numbers? And what can we say about the nature of battle that occurred during that 200-year period? My guest today is Rodney Stark, distinguished professor of the social sciences at Baylor University, co-director of the Institute for Studies of Religion, and author of more than 30 books, including The Rise of Christianity, For the Glory of God, The Victory of Reason, and Discovering God. One of his most recent works, and the one we will be discussing today, is entitled God's Battalions, The Case for the Crusades, published by Harper One Press. Rod, welcome to Research on Religion.
I'm delighted to be with you, Tony.
Well, let me begin by asking you, why write a book about the Crusades? I mean, there are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of books on this topic. What motivated you to add to the literature on this period of history?
Well, a number of things. For one thing, I've been reading military history all my life, practically.
Mm-hmm.
Never wrote any. This was a chance to write some, and I must say that it figured in my decision.
Yeah, I have to admit that the read of this book, which is an immensely readable book, and anybody who picks it up, and we'll have a link to it, will just find it to be a fascinating read. It's filled with a lot of military history, so it hits people on a lot of different levels.
Yeah, the real reason I wrote it is because I don't set myself up as an expert on the Crusades. I'm not. There are a whole bunch of marvelous historians who've been working on Crusade history for the last 30, 40 years who've completely revolutionized what we know about the whole period and about who went and why they went and whatnot. But somehow, and this so often happens, somehow their work isn't getting out to the public. So we still keep hearing about how the Crusaders was a bunch of bad guys who went east in pursuit of land and loot, which is absolutely not so. But the word isn't getting out. I mean, for example, right after 9/11, Bill Clinton went to Georgetown University and said, you know, let's face it, we've got a lot of responsibility in this whole thing because the Arabs have been angry for 1,000 years about what the terrible things that we did to them in the Crusades. Now, I'm not one of these nuts who thinks that Clinton's some kind of anti-American or whatever.
Right.
He's a decent American.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't say this to attack America or to run down Christianity. He said it because he'd been taught that.
Right.
As a matter of fact, even before 9/11, the New York Times in 1999 took time out to explain to all its readers that this was a predecessor to the Holocaust, that, that we were terrible, dreadful Christians, awful people, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the truth is, of course, that this culminated 450 years of Muslim invasions and terrorism towards the West. I want to get back to that to finish this conversation on why I wrote it, which is to end all of this nonsense and perhaps to strike against the kind of thing that we're seeing constantly. So take the case of Major Hassan, the guy who at Fort who had shot everybody.
Right.
What if he'd gotten up in front of a bunch of Army physicians and told them that he was a strong supporter of people who murdered abortionists?
Right.
He'd have been out of the Army in 10 minutes. But he got up and said he was a great supporter of Muslim terrorist suicide bombers. And everybody kind of looked down and gulped and didn't say a darn thing.
Right.
And we see this going on in the present administration. We can't talk about Islamic terrorists. They're some kind of terrorists or rebel. Well, we don't know what the heck to call them. We talk about man-made disasters, and I mean it's nonsense.
It is one of my favorite stories that you have in the book about this. The politically correct language that is surrounding the Crusades here comes on page 5 of the book. And if I could just read a passage here, that same year, this would be 1999, to mark the 900th anniversary of the Crusader conquest of Jerusalem, hundreds of devout Protestants took part in a reconciliation walk that began in Germany and ended in the Holy Land. Along the way, the walkers wore T-shirts bearing the message, "I apologize," in Arabic. How did that work out? Was the apology accepted?
Well, I mean, it worked out. It meant nothing
right.
to the Muslims, and it was a terrible disgrace to Western Christianity. And these people were simply saying that that the Crusaders were a bunch of crazy brutes.
Right. And now, as you mentioned in the book as well, this image of the Crusaders as a bunch of crazy brutes is not just something that has occurred in the past decade or so, but actually dates back. A number of scholars you cite date this back to early 20th century, late 19th century, and even back to the Enlightenment. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, I mean, when did serious attacks on Christianity, and particularly on the Catholic Church, really begin? And the answer is in the so-called Enlightenment. We're talking about Gibbons and Voltaire and these people. And they saw it as something to whip Christianity with, and they started these stories. I mean, Gibbons said that they went east to get rich.
Right.
Let's start with that.
Okay.
Because that's, you know, the biggest lie of them all.
So
they were so motivated to go east to get rich that they bankrupted themselves to do it, right?
Yeah.
There's nothing to be had out there. As a matter of fact, the reason that eventually Europe stopped sustaining the Crusader kingdoms in the east is because it cost so much money. They were not supported by local, you know, they couldn't squeeze enough out of the local area. It was an enormous export of European money was required to keep those small little operations going.
Right.
The interesting thing about, and there's a wonderful English historian named Jonathan Riley Smith, who amazingly discovered an enormous cache of incredible evidence about who the Crusaders were and how much it cost them to go. And that is, in those days, 11th century, the basic source of loans, if you will, in Europe were the monasteries and the convents.
Right.
They were extremely well run. They had money, and they had learned that they could lend it to the nobility at very high interest rates and make a lot of money. Consequently, and of course, they never throw anything away.
Right.
consequently, with what Riley Smith discovered, were hundreds and hundreds of mortgages signed by the first and second crusaders, borrowing funds to go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some of these people sold whole provinces of France, sold them in order to raise money to go. And they took out huge loans that they were not sure they could ever pay back. And, of course, most of them went out to the east and died along the way.
Right.
And never did redeem the mortgages. And so a whole bunch of property in Europe was transferred from the nobility to the religious orders because they cashed in their loans.
That was one of the interesting things I found in the book, that you found evidence that roughly a person who wants to go on a crusade, and we're talking here a member of the nobility,
right,
would often take out these mortgages that would be worth 4 to 5 times their annual income to go on a crusade. And when you think about doing this for the loot or for the money, for the pots of gold going into the land of milk and honey, however you want to put it, that was a really bad investment. If you were investment
banker, the land of locust and sand.
Right. I mean, the area that they were going into wasn't known for its riches, and on top of that, as you mentioned, many of these people got killed on the way. The nature of medieval battle at the time was hand to hand, very close quarter contact, and you were likely to either get killed or significantly maimed.
Well, not only that, but disease in the camps along the way killed a lot more than battle ever killed.
Mm-hmm.
That was still true in the American Civil War, by the way. I mean, it's 20th century that most of your troops aren't killed by disease or infection.
Yeah, that is one of the things that I often encounter with my students, that their vision of what went on during the Crusades and the battles is largely influenced by, you know, what they see in contemporary battles in Iraq or Afghanistan, and they don't have a strong conception of what battle meant back in those days, nor do they have the conception that battle and war and violence was pretty endemic throughout the entire European region, Middle East region, and indeed throughout the entire world back at that time.
Yeah, well, you know, as we try to understand who the Crusaders were and what they were about, I think three things are important. First of all, they were tough guys.
Mm-hmm.
They've been raised since infancy to fight.
Mm-hmm.
Nose to nose. I mean, you know, as you say, with swords. I mean, really bloody stuff.
It was a way of life. Nobody ever thought
That's
differently.
Right. And, you know, most of them who were still alive at 25 had killed somebody.
Mm-hmm.
So they were wild men in certain respects.
Right.
Secondly, they were very sinful,
mm-hmm.
particularly in things like coveting wives and all the rest. So they were constantly in need of atonement.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, many of these guys, okay, it was typical in this time for several centuries for an awful lot of prominent people to be told by their confessor that the only hope they possibly had of ever being forgiven was to take a pilgrimage to Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes barefoot, okay?
Right, and that it's a long distance, and they didn't have super trains back then.
Oh, that's right. I mean, people came all the way from Iceland to take these pilgrimages because they were, I mean, look, there was a guy who, you know, he murdered his archbishop.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's pretty heavy duty stuff here. And he says, you know, you better go to the Holy Land.
Right.
Number three is they went on these pilgrimages when their confessors told them because they were very religious men.
Mm-hmm.
Now we find it very hard to reconcile that we've got here a bunch of real tough guys, very sinful, and very religious, all at the same time.
Right.
But that's what you had. And I mean, there was one particular guy who was so bloody. He was such a, I mean, he was a dreadful person. But four different times, his confessor told him he had to take a pilgrimage to Jerusalem, and he went every time and came back and was just as bad as ever. But the point is, he went.
This was Fulk the Third, if I'm correct.
Yeah. And you know, there were. But the real, I think, test of the pudding comes down to this. About 30 to 40 years before Urban called for the crusade to Jerusalem, one of his predecessors called for a crusade to Spain. Now, we've got to understand that after the rise of Islam, there was this huge expansion.
Mm-hmm.
The Middle East was Christian. The whole of North Africa was Christian. There were probably more Christians in the Middle East and North Africa than there were in Europe.
Right.
Well, the Muslims rolled over this whole territory, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Then they crossed the Mediterranean and took nearly all of Spain.
Right.
They sent an army up into France. It was met at Tours and defeated.
Which is about 150 miles south of Paris.
That's right.
And so when a number of my students are quite surprised, they might have some idea about the Moors in Spain or in southern Spain, but they never really realized that they got pretty close to Paris.
That's right. And they took the whole of southern Italy.
Mm-hmm.
They did sack Rome.
Twice, I believe, right?
Right. They took Sicily. They took most of the islands.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't like this was a new thing. The Europeans had been having conflicts with Muslims this entire period. In any event, the Pope called for a crusade into Spain. The Spanish Christians had slowly been driving the Muslims south, and he wanted a bunch of knights from Frankish knights mostly to go south and join this.
Mm-hmm.
And he offered them the complete absolution of their sins, which later was offered to the first crusaders. You know, he told them there were possessions to be had down there.
Mm-hmm.
And Spain was rich. It had a lot of good land. It was close by.
Yeah, much more so than Palestine.
Yeah, well, and nobody went. And the reason they didn't go is that they had no idea that Jesus had walked around in Seville.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it didn't have any religious significance.
Right.
So 30, 40 years later, when Pope Urban asked them to go 2,500 miles with no prospects of gain.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe as many as 100,000 people saddled up and were put on their marching boots and went.
Right.
That's a big difference. And the only way it can be explained is in religious terms, certainly not in terms of material advantages or material attractions, because they weren't there.
That's true. And I think another fact that comes out in the book as well, too, was that the European economy at the time was actually growing.
Yep.
Yes. And
I mean, this was an expensive, really expensive undertaking.
Right.
And it wouldn't have been something, you know, Marxist historians have all kinds of fantasies about this. And one of them is that it was the knights had all these younger sons who weren't going to inherit.
Right.
And those are the people who went on the crusade because they were hoping, you know, to get some land and some loot for themselves. That's not who went. I mean, it was princes who led the four great sectors in the First Crusade. These were the, you know, the King of France would have gone, but the Pope wouldn't let him because he was married to a lady without having divorced his previous wife, and so he was excommunicated at the time, and he couldn't
right.
go. But the fact is, these were the heads of the great families that went. Another interesting thing comes out because Riley Smith can find out who went. It was like we find in the growth of all social movements. It was completely a network phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
There were a whole set of intermarried, interrelated families who supplied all the crusaders. I mean, either nobody from one of these kinship networks went, or just about everybody did. It was typical for a family for the head of the family and his five sons all to go.
Right.
And sometimes taking their wives with them.
And you note in the book that only about 10% of noble families actually participated, which meant 90% did not, which tells you that, you know, the other 90% were looking at this as, you know, this is not a good economic investment. If it was a good economic investment, they would be the first ones going down.
Right. But, you know, they that's right. It was fascinating to look at the stories of the various families who went and who didn't go. And by the way, this continued across the Crusades, that the same families kept sending, you know, in the Second Crusade it was the sons of the First Crusaders, in the Third Crusade it was the sons of the Second Crusaders. It just stayed in the family, despite the fact that that they knew more than the rest of the family, so that the probabilities were very much against them. Let's face it, it took them 2 years to get to Jerusalem.
Right.
And they were fighting and dying most of the second year because they had to move from Constantinople all the way down to Jerusalem. And there was a fight about every couple hundred miles.
Let me ask you about that, because that's another interesting aspect, again, that many of my students and many people that I know do not have a concept of, but just the actual undertaking of going from France to Palestine was not an easy endeavor. They didn't have transport planes to fly supplies ahead. They pretty much had to take everything on the go. So a prince who decides that he's going to go on the Crusades has to raise some money to, you know, buy a number of servants or to pay a number of servants and basic provisions along the way. And they also carried, as you mentioned, treasure wagons filled with gold coins on the way down.
Well, you know, they didn't, you know, money was gold.
Right.
And it's darn heavy.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason they had to take a bunch of money is because they couldn't, in fact, haul supplies from the West to sustain them on the march. That's impossible. They just simply, they couldn't take enough fodder for the horses, if nothing else. Consequently, they had to buy it along the way.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it led to serious conflicts with the locals along the way, but the point was they had treasure wagons loaded down with gold coins so that they could pay for stuff. It was an enormously expensive undertaking financially, and of course in terms of lives it was frightening, because you know, you start out with nobody knows how many started out, okay, but 90 to 100,000 isn't a bad guess for the First Crusade.
Right.
It's figured that when they got to Jerusalem, there were about 15,000 of them.
Mm-hmm.
There were almost no horses because they'd eaten them.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot more Muslim soldiers inside Jerusalem than there were Christians outside Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
And still they broke in and whipped them. On top of which, then, they had to immediately assemble and march south to head off a huge Egyptian army that greatly outnumbered them.
Mm-hmm.
They went down there and beat them, drove them away, and then they all went home. So a couple of months after the fall of Jerusalem, there are probably 200 knights left in the whole of Palestine, with maybe another few hundred foot soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, extremely vulnerable to reconquest, because they're sitting there in a little island in the midst of this great Muslim world. Fortunately for them, the Muslims there were many, many different Muslim regimes and Muslim territories involved, and the disorganization and the disputes and the antagonisms among the Muslims were what kept them able to hang on for a while until they could get resupplied. But
before we talk about the actual battles, and that's something I want to get to figure out how a tired bunch of soldiers who have been eating their horses defeats a much larger army than them. I want to step backwards a little bit and talk about the buying of provisions along the way And one of the most fascinating things I learned in your book was the issue about pillaging along the way, is that we have images today that the Crusaders were just going down like Muppets on methamphetamine, pillaging here, there, and everywhere. But as you note, they try buying provisions first, but if the local townsfolks were not that cooperative, these Crusaders were facing a situation where they either needed to eat or they were going to die. And so this oftentimes provoked the pillaging.
Right. I mean, there was certainly some looting and some pillaging. Amazingly little, actually, aside from the so-called People's Crusade, which was a bunch of unorganized, non-military types.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, let's forget that for the moment. You know, it's a really interesting thing. And of course, the other issue that I think that historians have been really careless about is that they somehow figure that there had to be a bunch of dirty pool involved, because how in the world could they go out there and beat all these Muslims? I mean, there must be something crazy going on.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact is European armies at this point in history were far superior to Muslim armies. And that had to do largely with organization. And one thing to do with weapons, which was the crossbow, which
mm-hmm.
had enormous impact. It's not much written about in European history, because it was considered an immoral and illegal weapon, but it was widely used. And it made a huge difference, because they're simply vastly more effective than the bow. So
mm-hmm.
they're really accurate, and it doesn't take much training to be good with one. I mean, you point it at something and pull the trigger, and wham! Instead of, you know, throwing that arrow way up into the air and hoping it comes down where you'd like it to come down.
And that was a significant technological advantage that the Crusaders and Europeans had. And this gets to that larger issue, which you devote a whole chapter to, about the differences between Muslim civilization in the year 1100 and European civilization. The contemporary image we have is that Europe was in the Dark Ages and Muslim civilization was flourishing at the time. But
That's the standard story.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I've written about the Dark Ages any number of times, because there never were any Dark Ages. It was a period of enormous technological and moral progress. It's amazing that people ever swallowed the Dark Ages thing again. It was just a way of putting down Christianity. But the fact is, you look at the fall of Rome and look at the civilization the Romans have.
Right.
And then you go to 1500, the so-called Enlightenment, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly, at this period, before any Enlightenment stuff is happening, Europe in an enormous number of ways is miles and miles and miles ahead of Rome.
Mm-hmm.
Where did all that progress come from? Well, did it happen in 2 weeks at the end of the Dark Ages? No, it happened that whole period that was so-called Dark Ages, which weren't dark.
Right.
The fact of the matter is, slavery was driven out of Europe by the 10th century.
Mm-hmm.
If we want to talk about moral progress.
Mm-hmm.
Windmills were so thick on the landscape in Europe that by the late 11th century, they were starting to sue each other for blocking each other's wind. Of course, Europe was at this time full of lawyers. I wouldn't call that necessarily progress. But in any event,
what about the military technology? I mean, you detail that.
Well, sure. There were a lot, first of all, the European chain-link armor
mm-hmm.
was good. Okay. The Muslims knew about it, but mostly didn't have it, didn't use it. Mostly that they had was hide shirts with some metal buttons sewed on them. But what was much more important is that the Muslims were almost entirely a cavalry force, but without stirrups and good saddles.
Mm-hmm.
So consequently, all they could do was swing swords and shoot with little little bows, because what they couldn't do was take shock. In other words,
right.
the knight sitting behind his long lance and thundering in and whacking you with the point of his lance.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't do that if you didn't have stirrups to brace in and a big saddle with a big back on it to keep you from being thrown off your horse.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Muslims didn't have decent saddles, and they didn't have stirrups.
Mm-hmm.
And consequently, now they learned to get out of the way and not accept these big thundering cavalry charges. But whenever they got trapped in a position where they couldn't get out of the way, they just got rolled.
Yeah.
But the big thing was, that the Europeans knew, was no cavalry, not even their own cavalry with their big lances and their thundering horses, can take infantry if the infantry haven't broken ranks and started to run.
Mm-hmm.
If they stand there with their big old lances butted into the ground behind their shields, I'm sorry, the horses don't have any effect.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they knew. And consequently, I mean, they were much better organized and much better disciplined. And they didn't break ranks and start running after people. I mean, and that's why they won.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact of the matter is this notion about Muslim civilization being so superior is also a great misunderstanding. Because the so-called advanced Muslim cultures we're talking about was really the culture of the subject peoples, not of the Arabs.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, it was the Nestorian Christians and the Jews and whatnot who had all this advanced culture. And when, in the 12th and 1300s, when the Muslims killed them off or made them convert, it all died. It all disappeared.
Right.
And so, you know, everybody's trying to explain, why did the Muslims suddenly turn so backward? They didn't turn backward. They'd never been forward.
Mm-hmm.
What happened is that, it turns out that this shouldn't be a secret either, because people in architecture, right, and say, of course, you know, all this wonderful Islamic architecture of medieval times was, of course, Byzantine architecture.
Right.
And all of these translations of, you know, all of the Greek intellectuals. Sure, it was in Arabic, but it had been translated into Arabic by Jews and Christians.
Mm-hmm.
And many of these mathematicians and whatnot that we celebrate as these great Muslim intellectuals, in fact, simply had Arabic names, but in fact weren't Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Arabic numbers aren't.
Mm-hmm.
You know? They're Hindu numbers.
They're Hindu, right, right.
And so there's an awful lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is that it didn't take such really large armies of Europeans to beat pretty sizable Muslim forces. And they did it again and again and again.
Let me take us back a little bit in history here and talk again about the motivations behind the Crusades and talk about, since we're talking about military affairs here. But one of the myths is that the Crusades were really unprovoked. But prior to 1095 and dating back to the early 600s, Muslims had been expanding throughout the region. Isn't that correct?
Right. No, I mean, there were twofold. First of all, Europe had been fighting Muslims for 450 years.
Right.
The Muslims kept coming. They kept coming into Central Europe through the back door, up through Bulgaria, Romania, and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
So there was that. I mean, it was maybe 30, 40 years before the First Crusade that the Normans, of all people, sailed all the way around up the Mediterranean and drove the Muslims out of Sicily and southern Italy.
Mm-hmm.
There was this warfare going on the whole time, but there was this other factor, which is pilgrims.
Right.
And there was this enormous industry, which, by the way, why some enlightened Muslim leaders had, in fact, treated Christian pilgrims reasonably well is because they brought a lot of money.
Yeah, it was a source of wealth,
there
taxation.
There were thousands and thousands of them coming
mm-hmm.
every year to a pilgrimage to the Holy Land. This could have been going on forever. I mean, it started, in the 4th century, 3rd century
right.
even. Well, suddenly, you've got a new bunch of Muslims moving in.
And this would be the Turks?
Yeah, who were much more uncivilized, if you will. And they started beating up on these people and robbing them and killing them and torturing them and holding them for ransom and all sorts of things. And of course, Europe was very aware of this because those who managed to come back were their friends and relatives.
Mm-hmm.
Came back and said, "My God, you know, they're carving our guts out there."
Mm-hmm.
This did not go over well. And then there was this destruction of Christian holy places. There was the Great Church of the Sepulchre, which had been built over what was thought to have been the tomb of Christ.
Right.
Because, there was this little tomb carved into the rock, consistent with the description in the New Testament. And this had been identified, for many, many centuries as the tomb. Well, this particular pasha said, destroy it.
Mm-hmm.
And they went down there with chisels and hammers and tried to destroy all trace of this tomb. And it destroyed the church that was over it, of course.
Right.
And that did not go over well in Europe.
No.
It would be like saying, well, they found the true cross and burned it. It was whether or not that really was the tomb of Christ, it was certainly thought to be. And it's still, of course, the small remains of it are still
right.
And as a holy place in Jerusalem.
And this highlights, I think, too, the religious motivations about the whole Crusades, because, they were messing with holy sites and very, very important symbols. You compare this to Spain, where I think it was Pope Alexander that had said, let's go and take right. over Spain. And nobody says, well, there's nothing really that holy about Spain. But when it comes to saying, hey, you're messing, with the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, that's a different matter there. And that, yeah. that motivates people. Religious belief actually does motivate people.
That's right. And the long and the short of it is that that's why they went.
Mm-hmm.
They went to make Jerusalem safe for Christian history and holy sites, and safe for pilgrims.
Right. And what about the plea from Byzantium at the time? Constantinople was facing the Seljuk Turks, and in part, Pope Urban II was responding to a call from Constantinople.
Right.
So how much did that factor in?
Well, I'm sure it entered into it a lot. The problem is Byzantium was so corrupt that it led to all kinds of bitterness and misunderstandings and some other, almost all the histories say what a terrible thing is that one of the Crusades sacked Constantinople.
Mm-hmm.
But if you follow the history and realize how many times they were literally betrayed by Constantinople.
Mm-hmm.
In the First Crusade, the emperor promised all sorts of things, but when the knights arrived, he was shocked that he found they weren't just a bunch of mercenaries he'd been hired and sent.
Right.
When he found out there were all these princes and barons and counts and noblemen, he didn't know what to make of it, so he sent them off towards... they expected him to lead.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't. He set them off, unsupported, didn't produce the supplies that were promised, betrayed them again and again, and this happened crusade after crusade. The Byzantines basically exploited them.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, there was this huge situation in which the Byzantines really had gotten the Knights into a situation where, you know, it was root hog or die, and so they rooted. They went over and they sacked them.
Mm-hmm.
This is considered to be this terrible, terrible sin because Constantinople was such a wonderful city. You get all this, you know, what about the art gallery sort of stuff?
Right.
You know, well, a bunch of knights out there have been betrayed for the umpteenth time and who haven't got anything to eat.
Right.
You can take your art gallery and forget it. You'll burn the darn thing.
Right.
And so, yeah. Another one of the great myths is about how some, about chivalry and the great Saladin.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, people like Karen Armstrong like to point out that Saladin was this wonderful man. And when he took Jerusalem, boy, he didn't murder the knights when they surrendered.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he wanted to, and it was the only time that he kept his word on that, because otherwise he was a bloodthirsty, nasty killer.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the whole notion that he was a sweet guy is just mythology.
Mm-hmm. And it doesn't fit with the way that, you know, battles and warfare was carried out during the time. They weren't too worried about collateral damage and...
Right, well, they also had a rule, which is, mm-hmm. when you lay siege to a city, fine, but if in the end the attackers have to take the city by storm, have to actually climb over the walls or bang through the walls and fight their way in, then the troops are free to loot and sack and murder.
Yeah.
And then that's to teach you a good lesson to other cities. Don't
put up a
fight.
Up to
the last day before we come over the walls, it's okay. If you surrender then, we'll make terms and, you know, people don't get slaughtered.
Right.
But if we have to take the heavy losses,
mm-hmm.
of fighting our way in over the walls and whatnot and getting a lot of our guys killed, then it's tough luck for you.
Right. We're going to take our pound of flesh as well from what
that's
you extracted.
Right. And that's what happened at Jerusalem. I mean, mm-hmm. the reason they didn't surrender is that they didn't think the Crusaders had a hope.
Right.
The Crusaders are there. They've got nothing. They're starving. They don't even have any wood to build a sultan, you know, siege machines much.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody says, here's what we're going to do, because I had a vision from God. We're going to get barefoot, and we're going to fast for 3 days, and we're going to march around the city.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're going to attack. Well, the walls were full of Muslim troops laughing at them as they barefoot walked around the city.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next morning they got up and went in, banged in.
Surprise. Yeah.
But, you know, there's a really funny story about the whole Saladin thing. In the 1890s, Kaiser Wilhelm of Germany went to the Middle East. And he laid a wreath on Saladin's tomb.
Mm-hmm.
And it said, from one great emperor to another.
Mm-hmm.
Was, you know, he was a complete horse's neck. But
right.
During World War I, T.E. Lawrence, with all his irregular Arabs who were fighting the Turks,
mm-hmm.
got to Saladin's tomb, and he liberated the wreath. It's now in the British War Museum.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that. Let me ask you, too. We've been talking about the princely soldiers that have gone down there, too. And one of the interesting chapters that you detail in your book is about the People's Crusade, especially during the First Crusade.
Yeah, that was when it was, yeah.
Yeah. There's some number of interesting characters that... It took up arms, essentially, or what arms that they could scavenge up to go down as well. Tell us a little bit about this People's Crusade and the First Crusade.
Well, the Pope sent preachers out to preach the Crusade. And by the way, the people were not used to preaching.
Right.
There were almost no rural churches at that time in Europe. Basically, the Christians ignored the Pentecostals. the church ignored the peasantry at a time when almost everybody was a peasant. But they sent out these people to preach the crusade. And they did. And by the way, pretty soon they started preaching church reform and forgot about the crusades and what the things that ended up eventually a few hundred years later in the Reformation. But meanwhile, they came into these villages and whatnot in these areas, and they were preaching the crusades and the fact that your sins would be atoned. You'd be, you know, you'd pop right into heaven when you died. Well, it was heady stuff, and nobody'd heard it before.
Right.
And so there they went. Next thing you know, a whole bunch of nobility decided that they were going to go too. And they did.
And again, to emphasize this, that they were whipped up by religious fervent, not so much by, you know, there's a land of milk and honey out there.
That's right. Oh, yeah. No, there was no such. I mean, they also had treasure. I mean, they pooled all their money and put everything. The People's Crusade was led by a fellow named Peter the Hermit. He was a weird little man, very small, never bathed, I guess didn't cut his hair. But everybody agrees that he was a phenomenal preacher, even the nobility. As a matter of fact, he screwed up any number of times in ways that would have gotten him, sent to perdition. But he was such a wonderful preacher, they kept forgiving him because he could preach so well.
Right.
But anyway, he preached up a crusade, and all of these ordinary people, if you will. I mean, these were not the despised underclass, as they're often depicted by historians, because the despised underclass hasn't got resources to do much of anything.
Right.
These are the middle class. These were small-town merchants and shoemakers and butchers and bakers and what have you.
They had some means to do
this. They pooled their funds and they took their families and they went, which was an awful thing because they had no business out there because they had no real military capacity. And eventually they went out ahead before the Knights ever even got there and got themselves all killed by the Muslims.
One of the interesting things that you note in your book as well, and this that the Crusades, especially the First Crusade and the People's Crusade, tends to correspond with a number of pogroms against the Jews during this time, largely committed by the People's Crusade. Is that correct?
No.
No, it's not. Okay,
no,
I got that wrong.
The People's Crusade has been implicated in this again and again, but close scrutiny doesn't really support it. They did some looting along the way to get supplies and whatnot. Now, the anti-Semitic attacks were done by knights. And, as you might expect, there were knights who belonged to the German wing of the First Crusade. And they were, none of them wanted the main operations at all. The worst one was a guy who was supposed to be organizing reinforcements to be coming afterwards. He got it in his head that it didn't make any sense to march 2,500 miles to fight the godless when you were leaving anti-Christian godless right here at home.
Right.
Who also happened to have a lot of money.
And
so he started in this borderland area of Germany along the Rhine. He started attacking the Jewish communities. And in every case, the local bishop, well, in the first place he went, the bishop heard he was coming and got all the Jews but 12 inside the bishop's palace. And, he couldn't get at him. He killed the 12 who weren't in there. The next place, the bishop also took in the Jews, but this time they weren't having any of that, and they broke into the bishop's palace. And from there on in, the bishops kept trying to protect the Jews, and often the bishop had to run for his life.
And
then these guys turned around and tried to, you know, to head out for the crusade. There were two other little groups, by the way, who did some of this as well. And in all three instances, when they got to Hungary, the Hungarians wouldn't let them come through. And one thing led to another, and they all got pretty much butchered by the Hungarian knights.
In the
Second Crusade, some of this happened again, and the Bishop of Clairvaux rode north and stopped it. The church was not directly, was not the instigator of these things, but was in fact the defender. And there are long, long excerpts from Jewish chronicles written at the time, making it very clear that the Christian bishops had protected them and that St. Bernard of Clairvaux had come to their rescue and it had saved the Jewish communities all along the Rhine at this particular time. Unfortunately, it never went away. This remained a hotbed of European anti-Semitism all the way through the Second World War.
I guess that also speaks a little bit to one of the myths that the Crusades happened to be an effort of mass evangelization throughout the region and such, that it really wasn't that the case of that, that these were motivated really kind of by a defensive reaction to protect their holy lands and such.
No, and look, the people who went were sophisticated. I mean, you know, we're talking about princes, not about shoemakers. And they all had relatives who'd been to the Holy Land. They knew at first hand about what was being done to Christian sites and to Christian pilgrims. They knew about... There were no surprises when they got out there. They knew what Muslim armies were like. They knew they could beat them. And did.
The last rumor that I want, or not rumor, but myth that I want to address that you bring up in your book, and I think this is interesting because it also speaks to the reason why the Crusades petered out eventually, was this myth that the Crusades represented the first colonial outreach or first colonialization of Europe into the Middle East, and that this colonization was really all about establishing territory and extracting resources from the Palestine Middle East areas. And, you know, speak to that a little bit.
Well, you know, they had a little strip of land along the coast of Israel. I mean, what basically about what today is Israel, but not as far inland. Not that that is very far, but and these were sustained for about 200 years. And some people like Karen Armstrong and various other leftist historians like to call them colonies. But as I understand it, a colony is a politically controlled by the colonial power, and B, extracts wealth from the area and sends it back to the colonial power. If that really is the definition, on the political control, there was none, okay? The leadership out in the Crusader kingdoms was entirely local. And as for the flow of funds, it was all from Europe to the Crusader kingdoms rather than anything coming from the Crusader kingdoms back.
So basically these outposts were heavily subsidized by Europe.
So heavily subsidized that they disappeared when the Europeans got sick of paying for it.
And that brings me to the issue of why, after 200 years, these Crusades eventually peter out. I mean, you mention in the book the role of taxes in Europe, and explain that a little bit.
Well, they you know, these things had to be funded.
Mm-hmm.
And periodically, troops would have to be sent to protect them. They were called additional crusades. It was expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And when kings became involved, you know, as long as it was the princes and the counts and the barons, they had to pay for it. But when kings got involved, kings being what they are, they taxed the people to pay
right.
for it. They didn't go and mortgage their kingdom. They told the monasteries to ante up, not
yep.
to lend the money, and they, you know, there were crusader taxes, and nobody likes taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, remember, only about 10% of Europeans' families had ever gotten involved in the Crusades. And the other folks got sick of paying.
Yep.
And so they stopped paying. And that was the end of that. It's amazing how close this is to some of the very modern situations. I suppose we could talk about Vietnam and...
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true, is that, you know, as I teach my class on world politics to students, one of the great driving aspects of all of world history is the issue of taxations, and whether people want to pay or forced to pay or stop paying has a huge impact on...
And Europeans stopped paying, and that was the end of the Crusades.
Mm-hmm.
There's one final thing that I think needs to be talked about before we get off.
Okay.
And that's this. The notion that the Muslims have been harboring anger about this for 1,000 years is complete nonsense. The Muslims hardly noticed the Crusades.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, only the little local outfits did. You know, back in Baghdad and whatnot, they couldn't care less.
Mm-hmm.
And there was essentially no memory of it.
So why does this come back up?
A wonderful new kind of topic in Europe in the 19th century, and people started writing novels like Ivanhoe and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And they they came back into favor. And it was from there that, in the first instance, the Muslims were reacquainted with the fact that there had been crusades.
Mm-hmm.
And then Muslim nationalists in the 20th century, when in fact there was European colonizing going on in mm-hmm. the Middle East, they latched onto the Crusades as propaganda fodder
mm-hmm.
for blaming Europe for all of their problems and their backwardness and all the rest of it. And especially after the formation of Israel.
Right.
That's when the Crusades became this burning issue. Nobody, for 900 years, nobody had even remembered them.
I mean, it just seemed to be the pattern of history back then in a regular way of life that
yeah.
one empire would expand and fight right. another empire back and forth,
right.
back and forth. So,
I mean, and these were, given it was really on the far boundaries of the Muslim world, they were pinpricks.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great. Just one last question here. How has your book been received?
Well, you know, I was expecting a lot of attacks.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect that what happened is that the places where I might have got them, they just decided to ignore the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
But all the reviews I've had have been very, very positive, with the exception of some little blogger at some small... kind of community college sort of place
mm-hmm.
in Wisconsin attacked me for being a right-wing nut and all kinds of wonderful things
mm-hmm.
because I don't understand Mark Saber. You know that whole line of
yeah.
standard sociological nonsense. You know. I'm sure, you know, if the Nation or the New Republic had reviewed it, I'd have gotten slammed, but they didn't.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a book, again, that I recommend to our listening audience here. It's highly readable, which is one of the things that I've liked about a number of your recent works, is that it's serious scholarship, but nonetheless really appeals to a broad audience of lay readers, and it avoids a lot of the jargon. And again, it reads much like a novel. The stories about the military crusades and Peter the Hermit and such are just absolutely wonderful. So, Rod, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion today.
I'm delighted to have been with you.
And for those of you folks who want links to the book and other things that we talked about here on the podcast, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org, and we'll be talking with you next week. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.